Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Inside the Issue, as tonight we focus on the management of metastatic BRCA-negative, triple-negative breast cancer. We have a great faculty tonight, Dr. Hope Rugo from the University of California, San Francisco, and the Helen Diller Family Comprehensive Cancer Center, and Dr. Tiffany Trena from Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center and the Breast Medicine Service in New York City. We have some other investigators and faculty who participated in a survey of their usual treatment practices. We'll show you more of that as we go through our slides tonight. As always, if you have any questions or cases you'd like to run by us, just type them into the chat room. We'll talk about as many of these as we have time. As we do in all our webinars, we have a short 1-minute pre and post meeting survey for you to take. If you take that, we'll learn a little bit about you and you'll get a lot more out of this meeting. We do webinars all the time. On Thursday, we'll be working with Katie Moore, who really pioneered the use of PARP inhibitors, a SOLO-1 trial in ovarian cancer. Then next week, we'll be working with Dr. Diver from MD Anderson, talking about AML and MDS. And then we'll be talking about metastatic colorectal cancer with Dr. Siamber and Hecht. We have a great program on localized non-small cell lung cancer, talking about neoadjuvant IOs. Tonight, and we're all talking about lung cancer more and more. We're doing a great program on a mantle cell program on September 26th. I want to see what the faculty thinks about the movement of BTK inhibitors into the first line setting. We're starting a new program, a new series on gastroesophageal cancers with Dr. Enziger from Dana-Farber. Then the first two Saturdays of October, put them on your calendar. We're going to be doing two all-day symposium. We're covering about 20 tumor types over these two Saturdays. First with the Florida Cancer Specialist. We have a great faculty, a bunch of different important cancers to talk about. And then the following week with the American Oncology Network, additional faculty, and it'll be two great Saturday programs. We know a lot of people end up listening to our programs. If you're into a podcast, check out our Oncology Today series, including a recent program with Dr. MacArthur talking about what happened at ASCO. But today, we're going to focus on this particular topic, metastatic disease in these patients. As we do for all our Inside the Issue series, I met with each faculty member over the last couple weeks to record their presentation. We don't want to use the time in this webinar to do that, but you can check these two presentations out. A lot more details about the cases that we're going to talk about tonight, and really comprehensive review of some of the data sets that relate to that. Here are the papers that are covered in these presentations. We're not going to go through all these, but we broke out with some of the things we think will be most interesting, and particularly the cases that are presented. We're going to integrate that as well as the faculty survey. So before we start rushing down through all the data that's out there, I just want to take a little bit of a deep breath because I was working, I think it was Friday night. I was going through your slides and cases and everything for this meeting. And Tiffany, I was just sort of looking at your case that we're about to present. I asked you two to both come up with cases of people who got on the checkpoint inhibitors in the metastatic setting and did well. I know that's not the typical situation, but I thought it'd be interesting to hear about it. And I was reviewing this case you presented of a 41-year-old woman who presented with a lesion picked up on mammography and unfortunately on workup was found to actually have metastatic disease. But what was particularly interesting and really got me thinking Friday night about this was this woman is a surgeon. And Tiffany, you shared with me that she is continuing and she's responding and doing well, but with metastatic disease, she continues to work. And I was just sort of sitting there envisioning what it's like. I had this image of her scrubbing for a procedure, imagining what the people, the other nurses, the doctors thought about working with somebody who had that level of dedication and kind of what it's like for you to take care of a patient like this, Tiffany. You know, one of the things we hear a lot from people in oncology, not just docs, but nurses is, the cocktail party question, isn't it depressing? And, you know, I thought about this woman as an example, and we could spend the whole hour talking about it, but I just thought maybe to sort of start out on a little bit more of a human note behind all these data, what it's like to take care of this woman and in general, how your patients inspire you, Tiffany.
Oh, I think you beautifully said that. I mean, our patients inspire me every day. I mean, I think that regardless of what they choose to do for a profession, the fact that, you know, it feels like a success and an achievement to enable our patients to do what is most important to them in their lives. So, you know, this particular patient is not only a surgeon, she's a mother of two young children. She juggles a lot. And we talk about what her values are and what is priority for her. And that's an important part of decision making when we talk about treatment options, because it's important that she takes that school break when her kids are off from school and they do that family vacation. And she needs to be able to be at her best to give to those around her and to do what feels satisfying for her. And so to see her live with her breast cancer on treatment fully, meeting what her priorities and values are, feels like a success. And we've come a long way compared to what treating breast cancer was like even just 10 years ago.
And you were telling me that sometimes you squeeze in a telemedicine visit between her cases in the OR?
Exactly. She's amazing. In her scrubs, kind of just dialing in for a quick telemed before she goes into the OR.
Hope, any thoughts? I know, again, we could talk about this all day long on sort of the other side of oncology that maybe other people, a lot of people don't realize is out there.
You know, I think that we, you know, our job is to help people live as long as possible with the best quality of life. But, and I think that in that we need to work with their true life, you know, what guides them, you know, what's most important to them, and how can we help them live that life in the best way possible? So, you know, if you spent your whole life trying to become something, you want to still do that. That's where your passion is. And we want to enable patients as much as is humanly possible. It isn't, obviously, sometimes to continue that. We want to enable them to go on holidays and see their kids, all of those things. You need to work with our patients in shared decision-making that isn't just about the next treatment, but also about how we can maximize their lifestyle to be what they need. And in the metastatic setting, that's quite a challenge, but incredibly important. One of my young patients who got diagnosed with de novo metastatic disease at 28, you know, the worst, luminal B ER positive disease, she and her husband had a baby with a surrogate, eggs harvested from and I can't remember who carried it. I think the surrogate was his sister. So they had harvested eggs for her beforehand, and then his sister carried the baby, and now they have a baby. They asked me about a second baby. It's not a good idea. But the first baby has been incredible because she's very sick now. But the baby is, you know, 2.5. It's been fabulous for her and for somebody who's getting those things taken away from them by the disease. This is an incredible thing to enable people to do.
So here's where we're heading the rest of the evening. I was just flashing on what it must be like to be a patient of your patient, Tiffany. It's a real privilege. Anyhow, we're going to talk about checkpoint inhibitors in this scenario of metastatic disease, of course, in the CPS positive patients. We'll talk about antibody drug conjugates, but particularly sacituzumab. Then we'll talk about HER2 low disease and, of course, TDXD. And then we'll talk about a bunch of other new developments that are coming along here. First, both of you had interesting slides to begin your talk, sort of setting the stage. And Hope, again, we're not going to focus on the PARP part of your algorithm, but maybe you can talk a little bit about sort of how you sort of think through the algorithm for this situation.
I think that we're all driven by a combination of when we see survival benefit and balancing that against toxicity and quality of life. So for every patient, you know, the same approach won't be the right thing. You know, somebody has active, you know, autoimmune disease, something like that. But if you have a patient whose tumor is PD-L1 positive, using the combined positive score, we see an improved survival by using pembrolizumab. So we really decide on the chemotherapy choice based on disease-free interval and evidence of resistance or sensitivity to taxanes. But we give those patients pembrolizumab because of the survival benefit. There is some interest, of course, in this maintenance with PARP inhibitors, but we won't talk about that more. I think we don't have the data on it, really. For patients who have PD-L1 negative disease, which is the majority of the patients that we see, I think then, you know, we're really using sequenced chemotherapy, and we welcomed the data from the antibody drug conjugates showing that something other than just giving one agent after another might help patients to live longer. So therefore, you know, sacituzumab, I think, is our go-to drug in the second line setting for triple negative disease. But now we also have trastuzumab deruxtecan that we could sequence after sacituzumab. And the sequencing of ADCs has become a very interesting research topic where we'll have data, more data over the next few years. And then, of course, next generation sequencing, which is an important part of looking at these patients' tumors. But I have to say, extremely rare that it's beneficial. There is some interest looking, for example, at new PI3 kinase inhibitors with chemo, et cetera, but we don't have any data yet. This is all really just experimental. So that's sort of our general thinking about how to manage patients with metastatic TNBC.
And Tiffany, this is a slide that you showed that really gets into the issue of how biomarkers are starting to be involved. I mean, doing CME, you know, maybe 5 years ago in triple negative breast cancer, it was just chemo, done, we're done, you know. Now, wow, as you can see, we can't even get through metastatic, part of metastatic in 1 hour. Can you talk about some of these major avenues now that are being pursued, Tiffany?
Yeah, absolutely. So as Hope said, I mean, you see in her algorithm, we really start with PD-L1 status and germline BRCA status is critically important because those are immediately actionable. But also, if we look at the development of ADCs, there are surface antigens that are relevant, right? TROP2, we don't need to screen for. We've seen data now in the hormone receptor negative and in the ER positive setting where ADCs like sacituzumab work regardless, right, of level of TROP2 expression. But that's not the case for, say, trastuzumab deruxtecan, where level of HER2 expression matters and HER2 low tumors clearly benefit from that ADC. Everything else shown here is really requiring further development and investigation, but I think that there are really exciting pathways that can be potentially targeted. So when you're doing your next-gen sequencing, I would say keep these categories in mind because there are clinical trials going on in all of these spaces for your patients. And I think that clinical trials are always a great option for our patients with triple-negative breast cancer these days.
So we're going to dive in and talk about checkpoint inhibitors first, but we already have an interesting question in the chat room, Hope, from Danny. Have you combined capecitabine with pembro in the first-line metastatic setting? He says, I know this wasn't a chemo partner in CAN-355, but we have data from other tumor sites. Any thoughts, Hope?
You know, it's such a great question because we like giving capecitabine since it's oral and, you know, you don't have quite the count suppression that we see with Gemcarbo or the neuropathy that we see with taxanes. But we don't have any data on this. And one study done in China that looked at all different kinds of chemo combinations, I have to say, I thought that maybe the capecitabine combination wasn't as active. We don't know that it stimulates the immune environment quite as much. And I think that may be really important for patients with breast cancer. So at the moment, unless there was a very compelling reason that you couldn't give the other two drugs that were studied, I wouldn't use capecitabine in that setting. We do give cape with pembro in the post-neoadjuvant setting, of course. We just don't really have any data on the benefits. And I think where you see a survival benefit, I'm always a little hesitant to substitute alternative chemo.
So here are some of the papers that Tiffany reviewed in her talk. And one thing we're not going to talk too much about, but I know a lot of oncologists are interested in, Tiffany, is the issue of IO plus PARP inhibitor in patients who are HR proficient, you know, not a typical target for olaparib. And for example, the DORA study that you mentioned in your talk. Any thoughts, though, about that strategy in general, Tiffany, where you see that heading?
Yeah, I mean, I'll say I'm hopeful that we see this as an encouraging strategy because we struggle with what to do with those patients who have both expression of PD-L1 and may have a germline BRCA mutation where, you know, we have two compelling therapies there in that first-line metastatic setting. And right now, guidelines would suggest favoring the IO approach for those patients, but I'd love to be able to maximize both the HRD deficiency as well as IO. So the DORA study looked at you know, using sensitivity to platinum as a surrogate biomarker for potential benefit from a PARP inhibitor and combining that with durvalumab. It's a non-randomized two-arm study. Some interesting efficacy data, biomarker work being done on that. We've seen some initial reports, but hopefully some additional data coming soon. And we await the results of an upfront randomized phase 3 study. So I think it's a space to keep an eye on, and hopefully we'll be able to say at some point for those dual biomarker expressing patients to be able to use a combination instead of having to choose one over the other.
So let's talk about potential benefits and risks of using IOs in metastatic disease, particularly the first line setting. And as I mentioned, both of you during your presentations went through a couple of patients who benefited from treatment. We won't go through the details of this. This is a 62-year-old woman, a patient at Tiffany's, who got carbo-pem and gemcitabine, although the gem was discontinued because of thrombocytopenia. But she's NED after 2 years. We just talked about the 41-year-old physician, NED after 4 years of NAB and atezo. And then Hope, you have this 72-year-old woman who's had a great response to NAB Pembro for about a year. And the first thing I want to sort of get your thoughts on is how often this occurs. You know, we have the lure of non-small cell lung cancer out there, but they have a lot of high PD-1 patients in the, you know, range of 50 or so or beyond that are, but you see 25% of those people with metastatic disease alive at 5 years, which is completely unprecedented. And Hope, I think everybody looks to that and similar data in other melanoma, et cetera, for the sort of so-called home run. But realistically, first of all, does it happen? I mean, I'd call these patients fitting into that category. But really, how often do you see this, Hope?
You know, it's hard to know. I think we see a small percentage, a handful of patients who have this kind of durable response where everything gets better. Interestingly, you know, this patient had HR positive disease, then became very triple negative. But I think, and, you know, extensive liver disease, so remarkable response. But we also see patients who have a very similar story or metastatic triple negative disease where you give the checkpoint inhibitor and chemo, and before you've actually thought about stopping the chemo, their cancer's already progressing. And so that's disappointing, even if we are, you know, I think one of the consolations we believe and, you know, talk with our patients about is that getting that immunotherapy might make the next treatments work better and for longer so that it's not just all about the first line treatment. But we did see improved survival with the use of this drug, even though most patients will not stay on forever without progression. So I think it's probably, and it's hard to know, 10% at most and maybe a little lower. I don't know, Tiffany.
Yeah, I do think it's the anecdote, it's the exception to the rule, but it feels like clearly we were able to easily find these patients in representative cases, and I feel like that's more than we might have seen in our practice 10 years ago.
Oh, much more. I agree with you. I mean, it's such a lifeline in the patients for whom it works for. But, you know, I have a patient who had a very high, I think her CPS was 20, and she started on NABPAC and Pembro. And, you know, I was having a fabulous response. And all of a sudden, from, you know, one visit to the next, 3 weeks later, her tumor like exploded. You know, so there's clearly mutations going on that create this problem. And, you know, then the cancer is not very responsive to other treatment. We just started her on ADC, but, you know, just really a remarkable resistance.
We're seeing, Tiffany, in a lot out in other areas of oncology, a lot of consolidation to around 2 years of an IO in a patient who's doing well. A lot of the trials stop at 2 years. Your patient, though, your surgeon's been on it for 4 years, and she's on atezo, so she's coming in every 2 weeks for treatment. What kind of discussions have you had? Any thoughts about cell-free DNA? You know, this comes up with the other cancers as a way, you know, maybe to look at these patients to decide.
Yeah. So historically, when we're talking about chemotherapy, generally in breast cancer, we continue to treat as opposed to sort of stopping and taking an indefinite holiday until progression. That's been sort of the characteristic pattern in, at least in the US and North America. I think that things may be know, clearly different in the HER2 positive space. And we've had trastuzumab and HER2 directed therapy now for quite some time. And there are trials being designed at this point to see when we can stop. So that question about when can we just discontinue therapy altogether and take a watch and wait approach has not really been so data supported and embraced in the breast cancer community. But I do think there are many drivers to choosing to stop at some point. Cumulative toxicity, for sure. You know, when somebody has achieved a complete response on scans, we wonder how much are they continuing to derive benefit and is the toxicity really outweighing that benefit? This becomes a very personalized discussion with our patients, limited by data to support that decision making. But some patients are really eager to stop and take that watch and wait approach, and others just more reluctant. Schedule is certainly an issue. We had talked about, you know, atezo being every 2 weeks. Pembrolizumab, you can dose every 6 weeks, and that would certainly introduce greater convenience for our patients. But my patient in particular opted to stay on the every 2 week because she didn't want to change anything that seemed to be working. And so I don't know if that's data-driven or just a bit of superstition, but I agreed, and we haven't stopped therapy for her.
So, and actually, anything you want to say about the scans on your patients? Pretty impressive, Hope.
Yeah, it is amazing. I mean, you can see there on the upper left-hand side how huge these tumors were and how they essentially went away. And then, you know, that you could see that there's still a little bit of hypoechoic area there on June of 23. So we thought, you know, we're going to stop the chemo. So we got a PET just to make sure. And there's nothing PET avid at all anywhere, including in the other, you know, she had lung nodules and a sternal mass. So it was a pretty dramatic response. And this, again, you know, patients who can stay on immunotherapy tend to have more of these dramatic responses. But we can see little bits of, you know, like hypoechoic areas on CT scans, et cetera. We just don't want to push the chemo when we feel like we've gotten maximum response.
So, Tiffany, this would be a great case for your fellows or medical students who want to learn about autoimmune toxicity, because this lady who actually had a great response also seems to be, you know, really a textbook of autoimmune problems. Can you kind of summarize some of the things that she has gone through and how this all responded to corticosteroids?
Yeah, absolutely. So she had had an early stage breast cancer that was actually ER, sort of weakly positive, ultimately ended up on adjuvant endocrine therapy, and then a few years later ended up in the emergency room with really acute shortness of breath, had a scan to rule out a PE, which showed essentially recurrent disease that was biopsy proven to be triple negative with a positive CPS score. And so she started on first-line therapy with chemotherapy and pembrolizumab, and within a month of having started that, had really blistering skin toxicity and dermatitis that required stopping the pembrolizumab, really holding therapy rather quickly. And within a month, her scans actually showed response just from that short amount of therapy. But she was quite symptomatic, took time on steroids for the dermatitis to try to settle a little bit. And when I met her about 3 to 4 months after that, she had quite poor performance status, still had the blistering skin reaction, had profound grade 3 diarrhea, unable to leave the bed, incontinent, short of breath at rest, pretty much had every IR immune-related adverse event you can imagine all in one. I admitted her right at that initial visit, and her scans showed essentially a complete response. She even had bronch and biopsy that showed resolution of the malignancy and just a lot of inflammatory change and organizing pneumonia. So she was started on high-dose steroids and required high-dose steroids for many, many months. I would say about 8 months later, her performance status was improving. She clinically was feeling so much better, but did have onset of some visual changes. And with that, an MRI found subcentimeter brain metastases that we were able to treat with just focal radiation. And she's remained to have good extracranial control. And with her improved performance status, I started olaparib at that point because of a somatic BRCA mutation. But she really had textbook explanation, textbook representation of some of our worst immune-related adverse events seen. But she also had a tremendous response, an anti-tumor response on her scans. So thankfully, you know, steroids really turned this around, settled down all that inflammation, and she clinically improved and now is doing well on just a PARP inhibitor alone. But it was certainly scary toxicity for some time.
I don't know if you know Jerushka Naidu. She's a lung investigator at ASCO. Yes. She was saying, you know her, she's saying she thinks there's a correlation, the best correlation with benefit is skin toxicity to IO. I'm like, where did that come? Because she's into this whole thing. But it was interesting. This lady had a great response, but started out with a lot of skin toxicity. Hope, what's a more typical, you know, type of autoimmune problem that you see? I would think thyroid would be the most common thing.
Yeah, I mean, it really varies between early and late stage disease. So in early stage disease, we see thyroid. It's by far the most common. But we actually see a fair bit of adrenal insufficiency, too. It's at least 5% if you include hypophysitis, which is the most common toxicity where you don't make ACTH, much more common than primary adrenal insufficiency. Rash is probably the next most common because rash is caused by a million things, so it's hard to differentiate. But those are really what we see now. We've all seen colitis, hepatitis, pneumonitis, myocarditis even. But in the metastatic setting, we see less of it relatively. So this patient is more unique. I have a patient who was on Pembro alone on the early Keynote trials, and she got terrible colitis. And what was fascinating to me about her is that we gave her steroids. She got better, you know, and then it just kept popping up again. You know, she's now 3 years off Pembro, 7 years with no disease, and she still gets diarrhea sort of at the turn of a hat. I mean, we caused an autoimmune problem, you know, and some other issues as well. Fascinating.
Well, maybe you uncovered one that was there. It wouldn't have been a problem if she hadn't gotten it. I'm going to go through some of the survey that we did. Here, really, the question of what the usual partner is when you use first-line IO with in Pembro. And you can see it sort of varies from NAB to paclitaxel, gemcarbo. While we're going through these, Tiffany Nicholas in the chat room wants to know, he said, we used to hear about hyperprogression. Do you ever see hyperprogression in breast? I don't even hear about that anymore in general with checkpoint inhibitors, the idea that Have you ever heard of that happening in breast cancer, Tiffany?
You know, it's funny. I think we used to talk about maybe pseudo progression and then realized, gosh, I don't think that's pseudo progression. I think that's really the disease getting worse, unfortunately, for our patients. So no, I don't think we talk about that so much. I don't know that that's such an entity, although Hope, in one of the cases she just talked about earlier this evening, described like sudden explosive disease after what was seemingly good disease control. I don't know that that's an entity, though.
I always thought when checkpoint inhibitors came out and they first talked about it, I always thought this was just disease progressing that just correlated. Mm-hmm. Also in the chat room, Hope Swati wants to know, when do you stop the chemo and keep the IO going?
It's a big question. We looked at this in Keynote 355, although it took us a number of years. And patients who stopped the chemo before Pembro, of course, are the people who were doing better. So it's a very biased evaluation. But those patients did, in fact, do better. There was even a suggestion in that analysis that patients who had an immune toxicity might have had a better outcome than patients who didn't have an immune toxicity, which is also kind of fascinating. So we have those, you know, hypothesis generating data from Keynote 355. So what I do is I treat to best response. And so basically, you know, as long as the tumors stop shrinking, you know, in this one patient, I did a PET scan too, just to be sure. Then I continue the checkpoint inhibitor alone and stop the chemo with the idea that, you know, depending on when progression is seen and if it's seen, you can always restart that chemo again, but at least you have a maintenance approach. Otherwise, we know that stopping everything based on randomized trials results in a worse outcome when the cancer grows again. So that, I think, is the best approach. I would say, you know, in oncology, we like round numbers, you know, six cycles of everything, right? So I usually say to patients, you should do 6 or 8 cycles. And then we sort of go from there.
So here's another question we asked. Actually, this kind of relates to your case, Tiffany, of the patient who had high PD-1, but also a somatic BRCA mutation, which is what comes first, checkpoint or PARP. And, you know, when we ask people questions like this and they all answer, give the same answer, I call it a consensus. That's our way of doing consensus conferences. And for a while now, I think since we saw the survival benefit of Pembro, everybody in general, I think, is starting out with a checkpoint inhibitor. This is interesting. I hope you were saying that you get NGS and all these people with metastatic disease, yet you hardly ever see anything that's helpful, but everybody does it on
we
the hope that
it.
You will find some. You know, you never
just
know, maybe there's
case.
An MSI out there. Tiffany went through the issues in terms of indications for germline testing, which of course has implications for the family as well. We talked before about this issue of combining PARP and IO and HRP patients. We'll sort of see where that's heading. But I want to move on now and talk about antibody-drug conjugates. Actually, we had a question or a comment in the chat room from Hassan who said, do you think that maybe ADC would be better to combine with IO than chemotherapy? And of course, we're seeing that throughout oncology, first-line therapy, diffuse large B-cell has an ADC. And now we're going to see probably an IO in that situation. In bladder cancer, we have IO ADC approved first line and enfortumab vedotin plus pembro. So the antibody drug conjugate part of this is obviously very important. And the one that we want to talk about in particular is sacituzumab, but also we're going to get into not only TDXD, but a bunch of ADCs that are coming along, and along with Hassan's thought, maybe you're going to end up in the first line setting. There are trials now starting to look at that. But I want to dive a little bit into sacituzumab. And, you know, Hope, maybe you can just start out talking a little bit about sort of your vision of what an ADC is and sort of the variables that we hear about in terms of the linker, the number of monoclonal antibodies, et cetera, how they differ in terms of how they're put together.
Yeah, I mean, this is such an exciting and interesting area, and you'd think we'd been doing it for so long that we would understand it better than we do, but we don't. And, you know, having been involved in the very beginning studies with T-DM1, it's interesting now to see this explosion of second/third generation ADCs. The biggest challenge in making the initial ADCs was having an antibody that would target the tumor preferentially over normal cells, and also where binding to the receptor would result in internalization. So that's key. Then you have to have a linker that's stable in plasma but can be easily digested in the tumor cell. And then lastly, the cytotoxic drug has to pack a big bang for the buck. So with a small amount of the payload that's delivered, you have to be able to have good cytotoxicity. So these started out as being drugs that couldn't be given as naked drugs because they were too toxic. So the new generation has done several things. The linker is improved. There are differential payloads. Antibodies relatively similar. Of course, we started with the trastuzumab, but now we have these highly selective and potent TROP2 antibodies, and there are others being studied as well. So that actually is the whole key. The other thing that we've thought about are two factors that are still a little unclear. So one is that the payload be more hydrophilic than hydrophobic, so it can leak out of the cell, as you can see to the right hand here, when the cell is killed, but leak out early and kill neighboring cells that might not express the target as high quantities, so-called bystander effect. The second is the drug-to-antibody ratio. The newer two drugs that are approved, sacituzumab govitecan and trastuzumab deruxtecan, have a high DAR, or drug-to-antibody ratio, at 7.5 or 8 to 1. But the problem is we have ADCs out there that are in clinical trials that either have a fairly hydrophobic payload or a low DAR, as low as 3.5 to 1, and are highly potent with an apparent bystander effect. So there's clearly many things that are playing a role here, including the potency of binding to the receptor. So maybe you can't even see the receptor with immunohistochemistry, but you can still bind that antibody enough to cause cell death. And I think this is really a very fascinating area that we're continuing to understand and to evaluate as we're looking for mechanisms of resistance.
So let's talk a little bit about sacituzumab in particular. You know, I was talking about bladder cancer. Sacituzumab's also approved in bladder cancer and as well. Can you talk about what sacituzumab is and, of course, what we've seen in terms of efficacy and tolerability, Hope?
Yeah, so sacituzumab is a first-in-class TROP2-directed ADC, and TROP2 is highly expressed. And in fact, all that data came from way old time, right? But now we've actually looked at the samples in the patients on the two randomized phase 3 trials, and the expression is like 95% of the tumor samples. So very highly expressed on tumor cells more than normal cells. So highly specific antibody, the linker, high drug-to-antibody ratio, and then a novel, at the time, a very novel toxin, a topoisomerase inhibitor that was the active metabolite of irinotecan, SN38. You could direct a novel toxin. You know, the cool thing when we started with triple-negative disease is that no one would have received irinotecan or a topoisomerase inhibitor for that matter. So you had a new toxin and a new way of delivering it. And in this initial phase one, it started out as a phase 1B umbrella trial, and then it expanded into a phase 2 trial with 108 patients, heavily pretreated with an amazing response that was actually quite durable, primary toxicity, neutropenia, and alopecia, quite common as well from this agent.
So before we get into your case, Hope, a couple of questions from the chat room, Tiffany. Danny has a 75-year-old woman with de novo metastatic triple-negative disease, did well on carbogen for about 2 years, but presented last month with double vision and facial droop. Mm. MRI was concerning for leptomeningeal disease. The patient's going to get RT. Quote, my plan is to switch to sacituzumab. Any data for sacituzumab efficacy in CNS disease, including leptomeningeal disease, Tiffany?
Oh, I'm sorry to hear about this progression. And I'm always curious what the extracranial disease is doing at the same time as there is CNS progression. Leptomeningeal disease really remains one of our big challenges, even beyond parenchymal brain metastases. So specific to leptomeningeal disease and sacituzumab, I'm not sure we have particular evidence there because lepto is often excluded from our clinical trials as an eligibility criterion. I think we've seen and have experience of folks receiving sacituzumab in the setting of parenchymal brain mets that have been stable treated brain metastases. We have data for trastuzumab deruxtecan, and we know that, you know, even though, as Hope described, the structure of an antibody-drug conjugate, we've had this thought that antibodies are too big and bulky to cross the blood-brain barrier. I think what we're seeing is that ability for important payloads to diffuse is quite helpful, and I think we are seeing benefit from these ADCs in patients with brain metastases. Just don't know if that translates to leptomeningeal disease necessarily with evidence from trials.
I'll just ask Hope, have you seen a patient with leptomeningeal disease who got treated by sacituzumab?
You know, I have seen a patient who had a short-term response. We also have, there is some data going on, but mainly looking at brain mets, not LMD. I don't know of LMD with sacituzumab. There is, however, a small study looking at LMD with TDXT, trastuzumab deruxtecan, and I've also seen clinical responses there for brain mets and for LMD. But, you know, the data with sacituzumab is quite nice as well, and I think we'll see more data with ongoing studies looking at this area in particular. For ASCENT, you know, the trial that was the phase 3 trial leading to approval showing improvement in PFS and overall survival, we only included a small number of patients with treated brain mets. So we, in those patients, the drug worked really, really well, but it wasn't untreated brain mets.
So continuing on, Danny back in the chat room says, interestingly, her tumor is HER2 low, but her EF is 30% and she survived a cardiac arrest 3 years ago.
Oh, goodness.
Never too simple. Before you get into your case, there's one more quick question I just want to throw in back from IO, because I don't remember anybody asking this question. I think it's a really cool question. This is from Alyssa, Tiffany, regarding autoimmune problems from IO. Has lower dose been tried?
Well, that's an interesting question. You know, so have patients who've developed an immune-related adverse event been re-challenged with a lower dose? I don't know that the dose itself matters so much. I think once the immune system is just so inflamed and activated, we come back to discussing the risk-benefit balance. I rely on our melanoma colleagues often. I have the benefit of Mike Pastow at my institution, who published the New England Journal article on immune-related adverse events. And there are times that I have chatted with him about whether somebody might be reasonable to re-challenge. And it's a very binary decision rather than a dose modification decision.
Well, congratulations to Alyssa, because anytime you can make an investigator go, wow, that's a really good question.
That's a good question.
And nobody ever asked that ever. So Hope, you had two cases you presented in detail in your presentation. The first one, a woman who responded to sacituzumab, and the second one who had toxicity issues. What happened with this 57-year-old lady? She got treated about a year ago.
Yes, I mean, I will say about the dosing in IO, as far as I know, lowering the dose doesn't change toxicity once you developed it. But in combinations, there is some suggested data that if you give two immune-targeted agents together, you know, this marked increase in toxicity, if you lower the dose of the one you're adding on, you might actually see less immune toxicity. So that's the only data that exists. Anyway, for this
ipilimumab for sure, there's a dose relationship, but not, right. I don't have never heard about PD-1.
Not with the PD-1. So when you add it in, it's really, you know, if you add in a lower dose with the checkpoint inhibitor, maybe you could get the efficacy goose along the immune response without the toxicity. Anyway, so it's an area to be explored. So 57-year-old, so she has metastatic triple-negative disease. She, again, originally came in with ER-positive disease, very interesting, and recurred in multiple neck and axillary nodes and rib, and had a small brain met, and then, you know, had radiation. They couldn't really tell what the cells were doing. They couldn't make a diagnosis. And so then she had capecitabine for 6 months and waited, actually, because she didn't have any other disease then. She went on, I think she was being treated in another institution. So then she came back to see me when she developed arm pain and weakness in her left arm. And this is very pathognomonic for breast oncologists. I think, you know, people come in with this arm pain and weakness, and you know it's brachial plexus infiltration, but you have to do special imaging to see it. So we found it. And now her tumor was triple negative and PD-L1 by CPS of 10. So she got paclitaxel and pembro with PD in her brachial plexus. And then capecitabine, again, had progression, and then this a lot of disease in her spinal control at spinal canal at C6. So then she started on sacituzumab, govatecan, and stayed on it for a long time. So she stayed on until May of this year, so 8 months altogether. But then unfortunately developed extensive leptomeningeal disease. And this does happen. You know, you just end up with a situation where you're treating and the cancer keeps escaping in different ways. But she really had a dramatic response, tolerated treatment incredibly well, only got two growth factor injections the whole time.
How about these images?
So just to note the images, you can see in September, sorry, I needed that prompt. In September of 2022, she had, as you can see, this disease in her brachial plexus under the axilla. She also had some mediastinal disease with nodes. And here you can see in January of 23, it's all gone. And in April of 23, it's mostly gone. There was a little bit of uptake there, but not much. But unfortunately, her MRI shows this sort of thickened dura, which is a little bit hard to see. But this thickened dura is all related to her leptomeningeal disease.
So how about your 40-year-old lady as an example of toxicity of sacituzumab? What happened with her? She got started on sacituzumab, April of last year.
Yeah, and it kind of goes along with the person who asked about giving checkpoint inhibitors with ADCs. You know, there's nice preclinical and even some clinical data suggesting that, you know, if you give the ADC, that you improve the response to immunotherapy. Anyway, she got treated again by another provider and was treated with a Keynote 522 type regimen for nasty triple negative disease, but had primary disease growth in the neoadjuvant setting, which we hate to see. So had surgery, had residual disease with high cellularity, and that cellularity is a really bad thing for these patients, even with the negative nodes. So then she took CAPE with ongoing pembro and she was actually being followed with ctDNA in another institution on a study, and she had ctDNA. They did scans, they found a solitary lung nodule and resected it. Then she had a witness seizure 2 months later and had multiple brain mets as well as multiple lung metastases at that time. She had whole brain radiation therapy. And again, PD-L1 CPS of 40. So she got sacituzumab for the progressive disease in her lung. So she, because she had the PD in lung. So she got sacituzumab and also pembrolizumab. I want to admit it's not on this slide, but we continued pembro. We got it on compassionate use because she is young and it's a horrible situation. You know, you kind of got all your heartstrings being tagged there. And her CPS was so high, she really wanted to do that. And she started in April of 22. And this is a patient whose cancer was growing on AC, multiple brain mets, you know, not very long after surgery, radiation, and while still on capecitabine, you know, lung mets, et cetera. She got one radiation to her left acetabulum, a little gamma knife, you know, stereotactic radiation. And then in February, she had new renal lesions on one side. We biopsied it, and it still had triple negative disease. So we did IMRT to the renal lesions. And she was on treatment from April until August the next year. So that is really a long time for this kind of patient. And she just changed therapy now. So what happened to her? I mean, this is a young woman. She wants to go visit her family in Europe and go to different concerts. She has a busy life with her partner. And she was just exhausted and had a lot of insomnia, had a lot of nausea. So we actually took away her dexamethasone and added olanzapine for the first 3 to 5 nights at bedtime. Dramatic improvement in symptoms. And that, one of the reasons we kept going with this radiation was she said she was tolerating the treatment so well. She had a lot of neutropenia. She hated filgrastim. So we changed to pegfilgrastim on day 9 after each cycle, day 8. And her symptoms completely went away. She was never neutropenic. And then every time she would travel to Europe, she'd have terrible diarrhea. So we solved that by prophylactic loperamide and, you know, watching whenever she changed her diet or had long travel. So really made a big difference. And as I said, you know, she had alopecia, but boy, she tolerated that therapy well. And I have to say it's the only patient I've ever had with this kind of rapid progression who's been on first-line therapy for this long with such good quality of life.
Pembro is good stuff. Pembro and sacituzumab. Is she still on Pembro? Yeah. I'm just kidding, but is she still on Pembro?
I said she had to stop her Pembro. We'll see what happens. She
oh, right.
With me,
right. just a coincidence. Anyhow, let's whip through some of these questions we asked the faculty. So this is a scenario of a patient who is PD-1 negative, IHC of 0. And we said, suppose you, what's your next form of therapy in a, after progressing on Gem/Carbo? Where she responded, but now has disease progression. So we had three scenarios. One, the patient's asymptomatic. The other, the patient has visceral symptomatic mets. The other, CNS involvement. And it looks like almost all these situations, people are saying sacituzumab. A couple of people, including Hope, brought in capecitabine a couple of times. And when we ask people when they're using sacituzumab, basically it's second line. One of the questions and one of the variables has been, Tiffany, how long since adjuvant therapy they need to be to think about going to sacituzumab as opposed to going back to an anthracycline taxane. Some people say 6 months, some say 12 months. How do you decide what the partner is going to be in that situation, Tiffany?
Yeah, so really asking around what is the optimal disease-free interval. And I tend to use that 1 year mark as a disease-free interval from their early stage adjuvant therapy and then try to introduce a first line before then reserving sacituzumab for the second line setting. But, you know, as Hope described, there's a bit of an art to this and the tempo of disease, the burden of disease, visceral metastases, I think all of that plays into it. So I wouldn't be so dogmatic about 12 months. Certainly short disease-free interval, about 6 months, has me very nervous. And I would really be thinking about sacituzumab earlier in that setting. But we have trials looking at this.
Ever since the HER2 low data came out, we've been asking this question, what comes first in HER2 low patients, sacituzumab or TDXD? And actually, it looks like there's a consensus here that sacituzumab, I think you get a little more debate, maybe with ER positive, but I'm not sure about that. But also we asked, what fraction of patients tolerate it without significant issues. And we see various estimates for what the likelihood is. We asked what the likelihood is a patient getting sacituzumab will need to have a therapy held or discontinued because of tolerability issues. You can see the estimates in general are a minority of patients.
Can I just make a comment about the serious problems? I was thinking any problem, right? Neutropenia, nausea, et cetera. I mean, nausea is a minimal problem, but neutropenia, most people get growth factors. So when I was thinking major problem, I didn't mean to see if people couldn't tolerate it. Just to qualify.
Right. Okay. Well, that's a good, and then in terms of GCFF, Tiffany, a little bit of difference in terms of whether it started up front. Dr. Bardia uses a secondary prophylaxis. You say heavily pretreated issues with neutropenia in the past or older patients, you start right from the beginning. Any comments on your experience with neutropenia and febrile neutropenia, Tiffany, with sacituzumab?
Yeah, I think febrile neutropenia, thankfully, is really uncommon. And I think you may see that in my colleagues' experience as well. You know, I see less of an issue by incorporating that growth factor, and it helps to keep people on track and tolerate it well. And I do similar to Hope in day 9 or day 8 on pro so that it supports the patient through the whole next cycle.
So we're only going to show one of these slides, but if you want to look in the chat room, we have a whole bunch of other slides asking our panel of investigators what they think about various trials that are ongoing. And I brought this one up, and there have been a lot of comments in the chat room about combining ADCs and IO, because again, in oncology, you're seeing more and more of that. And this is, Hope, the ASCENT-5 trial, sacituzumab and pembro versus pembro with or without capecitabine for patients with residual disease. We asked the investigators, if you look through the rest of these trials, 1 to 4, how enthusiastic would you be about putting your patient on a study like that? And Hope and Tiffany both rate this one as a 4. Hope, any thoughts about this? When you think we might be seeing data and any predictions about what you think we might see?
Well, I think it's a good trial, but just as a, you know, disclaimer, I was involved in the discussions regarding the design of the trial, and I'm doing a safety sub-study here. So you know, I think sacituzumab is highly effective. We've all moved the drug earlier in the metastatic setting, seen less toxicity and longer efficacy, as I showed you in that patient where I gave it in the first line. So it makes a lot of sense for me to test this agent in the post-neoadjuvant setting and to continue the pembro because of our data suggesting patients without a PCR do better if they got pembro from KEYNOTE-522. So to me, I think it's a really exciting next approach. It started enrolling this year, so it's going to be some time before we have results in any of these post-neoadjuvant studies. It's an interesting question that says, you know, control arm problematic, not all patients getting CAPE. But the thing is, you don't have to give your patient CAPE. Everybody gets pembro in both arms and sacituzumab in one arm and treatment of physician choice in the other. So, you know, most patients, I think, will get CAPE who are randomized to the control arm. And I think that the toxicity of sacituzumab is likely to be much less in this setting. We'll see.
Should be interesting to see that. And here is the ASCENT trial, the phase 3 trial. Hope was just referring to a really great hazard rate in terms of progression-free survival, 0.41, survival, 0.48. But one of the things that, I don't know, wasn't on my radar, Hope, was patients like your patient, I think it was the last patient, who started out ER positive, but by the time they had got treated were triple negative, you know, they lost their ER or whatever. That this is like a lot of patients in the ASCENT trial. It was a pretty common scenario. I think more than a third, but also it looks like the benefit was exactly the same. Although, I mean, sacituzumab works in ER positive disease too, but any thoughts about this when you saw that, Hope?
You know, we tend to see, I was really interested, actually, specifically in this endpoint, because I think these tumors tend to be luminal B, but they become very resistant to therapy. And we haven't really studied it enough to know if they convert to be more basal-like in a subset. They certainly look like it phenotypically. So I think that, you know, it's really encouraging to see that people who started out with something else initially, if they were triple negative in the metastatic setting, they benefited similarly from sacituzumab. And of course, now we have the TROPICS trial in ER-positive disease.
So I want to talk a little bit more about some other ADCs, and particularly T-DXd and HER2-low. Tiffany, you seem like you have a lot of doctors that are patients in your practice, which I can understand. I think probably both of you do. But 68-year-old practicing physician, HER2-low, what happened to her when she got T-DXd?
Yeah, absolutely. So she ultimately, after adjuvant therapy, did recur with bone metastases, had first-line therapy, her mets were triple negative, HER2 low, and progressed rather quickly through first line platinum. And so I used T-DXd for her in the second line setting with denosumab, and she has had a beautiful response. I was really nervous after just 3 months, pretty quick progression on platinum, but she's been on T-DXd since October 22 and really doing beautifully, tolerating it well, having nice response in bone as well as nodes that she had. So, you know, I think she was a great candidate for this. Her primary was, she had two primaries, a more strongly hormone receptor positive and then an ER low, HER2 low. So being able to incorporate T-DXd worked beautifully. It really reflected the DESTINY-Breast04 population.
So, Hope, one of the things I noticed about Tiffany's case is not only was the patient HER2 low, but the patient had an ERBB2 mutation. And I was telling her that, you know, one of the really interesting things in non-small cell lung cancer is that not only does T-DXd seem to work with HER2 mutant disease, but it actually looks like it works better than with HER2 overexpressing disease. Now, this is lung cancer. It's not breast cancer. It's just you guys don't have that many HER2 mutant patients. So I wonder whether, you know, maybe that is going to carry over to breast. This lady had both HER2 low and ERBB2. I'm not sure how often you would see ERBB2 alone. But any thoughts, though, about T-DXd and HER2 mutant versus overexpressing, Hope?
You know, HER2 mutant, the ERBB2 somatic mutations are quite uncommon, particularly in triple negative disease. They're less than 5%. So that's an unusual patient. But we have seen some responses in triple negative HER2 low breast cancer. So I'm sure it's not related to the somatic mutation. The somatic mutation might help the drug to work better, but we're not going to have data on that. Maybe ever, we'll see, because it's hard to get around the HER2 low. And I think it might even be hard to get around it in lung cancer, you know, just because there is some expression of HER2 along with the somatic mutations. But the drug works well in HER2 low disease. You know, it was exploratory in the triple negative population, which is why I think most of us are still using sacituzumab first, as you saw in the poll. But, you know, the efficacy exists, and I think understanding the sequencing is going to be really important. It's about a third of triple negative patients have IHC 1 plus or 2 plus without gene amplification. That said, we all have this slide. It's so funny, but although I really like the blue box, but that said, you know, there is incredible controversy about this. You know, we've all gone into our databases and looked at the HER2 low and said it doesn't, you know, impact prognosis or response to neoadjuvant therapy, and then had the laboratory folks go up and say, you don't actually know anything because HER2 low is impossible to really diagnose. You know, it is not really an entity by IHC because you miss so much of between 0 and 1 plus. So, you know, DESTINY-Breast06 is looking at the HR-positive population and includes, out of 850 patients, 150 who have ultra-low. So not 0, but less than 1 plus. And that's going to be very interesting. I can't imagine our pathologists ever wanting to tell us who's not 0, but less than 1 plus. But we'll see what happens with that data.
So I got to say, you can imagine the number of slides I've seen in the last couple of years on HER2 low. But when Tiffany put that slide up, I think it was because of the way she did it. I noticed something that I've never noticed before. And I bet you a lot of the audience, I mean, I don't know, maybe I'm the last person to figure this out, but it's just a very simple thing that HER2 low is much more common when you're ER positive. It's twice as common, right? You 63%
yes.
HER2 low.
It runs.
And
yeah.
A third in triple negative. Simple
it runs
thing,
together
but, I mean,
with luminal luminal B is more common, HER2 low, and it goes along with ER. And so you really have to be careful because otherwise you make think it has something to do with prognosis, but it's really just a surrogate for ER in this situation. And the what's really interesting, if you look at ERBB2 transcripts, they're lower in triple negative disease than in ER positive disease.
So just a couple other things just to finish out here. We asked a bunch of poll questions again. You can sort of check this out, but we want to just reserve the last couple minutes to get your thoughts about some other agents, some new agents. Here are some of the trials you were talking about. Some of these combination trials are really wild, you know, TDXD and IO, okay, but also I think capivasertib in there, which is pretty interesting to see that as well. Dato DXD, TDXD and durvalumab. And here's the DAISY trial. I think everybody's been talking about in terms of what you were saying, IEC low or zero. But I want to just get your thoughts first, Tiffany, about Dato. Of course, we're hearing a lot about that in lung cancer. It's looking promising. We're waiting for the phase 3 trial to see if it's going to become a second line therapy. What do we know about Dato without looking at the slides? Just the sort of top line about Dato and breast cancer and where you see that heading.
Sure, thanks. So Dato-DXD is an antibody-drug conjugate against TROP2, but with that deruxtecan payload that we're familiar with from trastuzumab deruxtecan. We've seen really exciting data in TNBC from the Pan-TROPION-01 study. You know, in a population of patients that had a median of 3 prior lines of therapy, really high response rates, and some of those patients had seen prior topoisomerase-directed therapies and other anti-TROP2 ADCs. So we've got interesting sort of early data. We've got a first-line trial going on right now in metastatic triple-negative breast cancer for PD-L1 negative patients. And we've seen from the Begonia trial, which Dr. Schmidt just presented recently, a cohort of patients getting Dato plus durvalumab. And in the first-line setting, response rates were around 80%. And that was unselected for PD-L1. So a lot of us wonder, you know, the majority of those patients actually were PD-L1 negative. So it looks like a highly active drug. And the side effect profile is different than what we see with SASE and also different than what we see with trastuzumab deruxtecan. Mucositis is an issue. Stomatitis can be prophylaxed against with an oral dex rinse and with ice chips. ILD has been rare, sort of 1% to 2%. You know, really a very well-tolerated drug, dosed that every 3-week schedule, just like trastuzumab deruxtecan. So I think it is certainly an ADC to keep an eye out for.
So final comment from Hope about two other agents. So I think it was yesterday at the World Lung Conference, patritumab deruxtecan, HER3 directed antibody, was presented in people with non-small cell EGFR mutant progressing on osimertinib and chemo. Interesting, 30% response rate. And then we were talking about this AML-MDS program we're doing with Dr. Daver, I think next week or the week after. I want to find out what happened to magrolimab because that seems to be crashing in MDS and AML, but you guys are starting it in breast. So patritumab and magrolimab, Hope, any hopes for those?
Well, patritumab is a really interesting drug, a HER3 ADC. Again, we need some new toxins, payloads, but it's deruxtecan is the same payload. It actually seems to be pretty well tolerated. It does have, you know, some nausea and ILD, similar to what we've seen with TDXD. There was some reports early of thrombocytopenia, which would be unique, kind of like we see that unique stomatitis with Dato-DXD. But in the study that was recently presented, looking at treating patients a little bit earlier, we saw that there was seemed to be a lot less thrombocytopenia as an issue. There was efficacy regardless of HER3 expression, which I think is really interesting. That you know, you see that it. Sort of similar to what we've been seeing with the other very potent ADCs, that you're seeing this, you know, responses that can be quite durable. So then the question is how to not step on each other's feet, patritumab or HER3 DXD, because people can't say patritumab, is owned by Daiichi, whereas the other two, Dato-DXD and TDXD, are collaborations with AZ. So the real question is, where is patritumab deruxtecan going to fit? There's a neoadjuvant trial, the Valentine study, going on in Spain, but it's not, you know, it may not be very definitive. So we'll see where that goes. Magrolimab is a fascinating agent, and we need things that enhance the immune response, preclinical data with the do not eat me signal, the anti-CD47, has been very encouraging data from down the road for me at Stanford. So combining it with sacituzumab, I think, is a really cool idea. It's way too early to really know what it will show in solid tumors. And there are other anti-CD47 antibodies that are being studied as well.
So I like the idea of the Valentine study. I think I ought to be the PI on that one. But in any event, so Hope and Tiffany, thank you so much for working with us tonight. So much going on now in oncology, breast oncology, triple negative disease. Speaking of a lot going on, coming back on Thursday, we'll hear what Katie Moore has to say about what's new with ovarian cancer. Audience, thank you for attending. Be safe, stay well, and have a great night. Thanks so much, Hope. Thanks, Tiffany.
Thank you
so much.
Thank you. Great to work with you.